not one of the one-sided presentations of Buddhism, which is still quite widely current, is that Buddhism is rationalistic. I'm not saying rational, I'm saying rationalistic. A presentation which sees Buddhism entirely and exclusively in terms of rationalism. This particular presentation says that Buddhism appeals only, or at least appeals primarily, to the reason. It says that Buddhism is a philosophy rather than a religion. For instance, Dr. George Grimm, a great German Buddhist scholar, had written a thick book which is entitled Buddhism, the Religion of Reason. This is characteristic. He selects reason as the distinguishing feature of Buddhism, and he calls it Buddhism, the philosophy, the religion of reason. Now, he wrote this book about 40 years ago, and it's rather significant that very recently, in a new edition, there's an emendation to the title, and it's now called Buddhism, the Religion of Reason and Meditation. But you see, meditation comes in as an afterthought. There's an appendix tacked on about meditation. Primary conception is of Buddhism, the religion of reason, with meditation, as I said, just tacked on as a sort of afterthought. Even so, the change is significant. 40 years ago, one could publish a book and call it Buddhism, the Religion of Reason, and leave it at that. But nowadays, one has at least to act and meditation. One has at least to bow in the direction of meditation, genuflect in the direction of meditation, if nothing else. Now, George Grimm, as I've said, was a German scholar. He was a European, a Westerner. But we mustn't think that this rationalistic, reason-only type of presentation of Buddhism is found only in the West. It is found, or has begun to be found, also in the East, especially in some of the Theravada countries and among English-knowing Buddhists, including English-knowing monks. I remember in the course of my own travels and adventures and studies in the East, I have sometimes been told myself that, by Eastern Buddhists, Buddhism is based on pure reason. Or sometimes it has been said, sometimes told me, Buddhism is scientific. This is a very popular ploy nowadays. Or sometimes even Buddhism anticipates modern science. Several Eastern Buddhists have written very big books to demonstrate that all modern scientific discoveries, including things like genes and atom bombs, were all anticipated by the Buddha and thought out by him. And if you study the Abhidharma hard enough, you can find them all there. It is a very popular sort of approach and presentation in some quarters in the East nowadays. And sometimes even I have been told by some Eastern Buddhists that modern science proves Buddhism. This again is a very popular ploy. In lots of Buddhist magazines which are issued in the East, you find this sort of argument, that science is the supreme sort of arbiter, as it were, and science has succeeded in proving the truth of Buddhism, that science demonstrates that Buddhism is true. Buddhism is a scientific religion. Or sometimes it's even said, Buddhism is pure science. Now, this is all, I'm afraid, very naive indeed. It's not, of course, that there are no non-rational elements in Buddhism in the Theravada countries. There are plenty of these non-rational elements, fortunately. Otherwise, Buddhism would have been dead in these countries long ago. I sometimes put the matter a little paradoxically and say that it's better to have a bit of superstition rather than too much pure rationalism. You can perhaps compare rationalism to a garden made entirely of rock and gravel. It may look quite nice and neat and clean, a nice area of cement and a few nice rocks and pieces of stone dispersed here and there, and gravel walks, no trees, or no grass, no flowers. It may be quite beautiful in a way, at least quite functional and hygienic as it were, but though it may be beautiful, it will be sterile. Nothing will grow. But we may say, on the other hand, that superstition is rather like a garden which is full of weeds. Even though the weeds in a way are undesirable things, the fact that there are so many weeds at least shows that the soil is good, the soil is fertile. So we can make this sort of comparison. The rationalistic type of presentation is more like this beautiful but sterile rock and stone garden, whereas a more superstitious sort of element, though much has to be weeded out, is rather like the garden with many weeds, which at least prove its fertility and richness. I've sometimes found in the East that English-knowing monks, especially in the Theravada countries, are a bit ashamed of the non-rational element in popular Buddhism, especially, for instance, in Ceylon. I remember when I went first to Ceylon in 1945, I think it was, or end of 1944. I went one day to a temple not far from Colombo. And there was a great courtyard. I entered that. And immediately to the left, there was a temple with all sorts of gods and goddesses. So I thought, that's strange. Perhaps I made a mistake. I thought, maybe I haven't come to a Buddhist temple at all. So I went up and looked at these images. And sure enough, they were images of Hindu gods. There was Shiva. There was Ganesha, the elephant-headed god. There was Lakshmi, there's Kartikeya, the Hindu god of war. So that's very strange. I know this is a Buddhist temple. How did they come to be here? So a monk came up, a Buddhist monk came up, a Sinhalese, and he happened to know English, so I asked him, what are all these gods and goddesses doing here within the precincts of a Buddhist temple? I thought only the Buddha would be found here. So he said, oh, they're just for the lay people to worship. We don't worship them. So this was the sort of attitude, as it were. He said, they're just for the benefit of the laity. But this, I felt at the time, and I still feel, is a sort of potentially dangerous situation. You get, as it were, a rationalistic sangha, a rationalistic monastic order, and a superstitious laity. And in this way, a sort of what we may describe as schizophrenia of the Buddhist community develops. Not unlike, for instance, the situation which you had in this country in the 18th century, when clergy, the local parsons, even though they were continuing to administer the sacraments and preach, were really at heart skeptics and rationalists. But the people, the flock, the sheep, in other words, they continued to believe firmly in Christianity. So the two were alienated from each other, as it were, and a sort of split in the religious community occurs. So this sort of situation I did find very much in Ceylon. Sometimes I found that when official Buddhism in Ceylon suppressed the non-rational elements, didn't allow them to find expression within the field of Buddhism, which was kept all sort of clean and neat and rational, then they found expression outside Buddhism. I remember in this connection a very interesting, very lengthy correspondence which ensued in one of the best-known Sinhalese Buddhist magazines, English Buddhist magazines, on the subject of what they called koils. A koil is a Hindu temple in Ceylon and in South India. And according to this correspondence, which it went on for a couple of years, I think, more Hindu temples were being built in Ceylon than Buddhist temples, year by year. And the number of Hindu temples was increasing proportionately all the time. Now, the population of Ceylon is predominantly Buddhist, not Hindu. Hindu is a minority. So how was it that more Hindu temples were being built, more temples for Hindu gods than for the Buddha? So it wasn't because they were being built by Hindus, but because Buddhists were building, lay Buddhists, that is to say, ordinary Buddhists, were building not temples to the Buddha, but temples to these Hindu gods and goddesses. So why is this? The reason is that the gods and goddesses of Hinduism, which are sort of closer to the soil than the rather rationalistic Buddha of official Ceylon Buddhism, these Hindu gods and goddesses correspond to those aspects of the Sinhalese psyche, as we may say, that the official Buddhism was unable to cope with and did not, in fact, recognize. So I think this is a very significant and interesting situation, which, if we're not careful, or if the Sinhalese Buddhists are not careful, may well mark the beginning of the end of Buddhism in Ceylon. Now, of course, we mustn't go to the other extreme. We mustn't deny that there is a rational element in Buddhism. In fact, the rational element in Buddhism is very strong indeed. And we may go so far as to say that Buddhism is the most rational of all the great religions. But at the same time, and this is the point I want to stress, it is by no means a purely rational. A strong rational element, but not rationalistic, not exclusively rational. After all, we may ask ourselves, what is Buddhism as a teaching trying to do? Basically, essentially, as a teaching, Buddhism is trying to communicate what we can only describe as a mystery. It's trying to communicate the mystery of enlightenment, the mystery of the Buddha's enlightenment, and trying to communicate that mystery, some hint or some glimpse or some intimation of that mystery, to unenlightened man, and trying to communicate it in such a way that unenlightened man, to the measure of his ability, to the measure of his capacity, can actually participate in it. Now, when Buddhism tries to communicate this mystery of the Buddha's enlightenment to man, to unenlightened man, it's obviously trying to communicate it to the whole man, not just to a part of him, but to man in his totality, in all his aspects, all his dimensions, as it were, the whole being, the whole man. And man, we know, is not a simple being. Man is a sort of composite being. To put it very simply, even crudely, man consists of three things. There's the head, there's the heart, and there's the hand. Man is these three things. There's the conscious surface, we may say alternatively, and there are also the unconscious depths. So in order to communicate fully the mystery of the of enlightenment, of the Buddha's enlightenment, Buddhism has to get at, as it were, all of these. Head, heart, hand. Conscious surface and unconscious depths. Has to communicate with them all and speak to them all as best it can. Otherwise, there's no real contact, no full communication. If Buddhism is only the head, or only the heart, or even only the hand.